Increased self-awareness is usually a mixed blessing. The child is comfortable as he is. The adult talks constantly of the need of finding himself. In the childhood of the race, men were comfortable with their inherited labels. Whatever ties of family, of clan, of tribe, of religion, of country, into which they'd been born. In more recent times, we have begun to question each of these labels. And in time, in each of our lives, they all become problematic. Now, for the fathers of our fathers, it was a simple fact. They were Jews. They were born to be Jews. They lived an intensely Jewish life. The world about them declared them to be Jews, defined them as Jews. Jewish life provided a rich web of custom and of law, which formed their character and gave a particular color to their lives. And the religion provided them with a series of reassuring structures, categories of thought, which allowed them to feel that belonging to the Jewish people was of supreme importance. Had not God chosen the Jewish people and granted to them a covenant and given them a law? Had not God declared that Israel was an Am Skula, a people especially beloved to him? And did not the history of Israel have some kind of mysterious, miraculous significance in God's providential care for the world? What that significance was, they were not quite sure. But as they looked about them, they knew that their history had been significant. They had given so much to the world, and the world thought so much about them. And that was enough. They were Jews. For our fathers' fathers, to leave the Jewish world was an act of will. It required the deliberate casting off of one set of loyalties and the willful, willing adoption of another's. Moreover, the other set of loyalties which had to be adopted, that of the Christian world, were the loyalties of the enemy. We think of Christianity and of the other religions in the modern world as complementary ways to spiritual growth. To the Jew in the medieval world, Christianity was the enemy. It was Christ with a club. The gospel of love might be taught in the churches, but the churches were also taught their people to be angry with the non-believer and the heretic. And the Jew was conscious of how often, particularly at this season of the year, pastors would exhort their flock about the Christ killers and would lead them out into the street to bloody a few Christ killer heads. To move away from the Jewish community then was to be a deliberate traitor to it. And there was a hard and difficult road to go. Our fathers were Jews, they were comfortable as Jews, and they rarely asked the question, what is the meaning of Jewish survival, and is it important for me to remain within the community of Israel? And then, as they became aware of themselves as Jews, they became aware of the fact that they had a particular role to play in history. If you unroll the scroll of the Torah, you look at the book of Deuteronomy at the sixth chapter, which includes the watchword of our faith, the famous Shema, you will find that two letters of that line are written double-sized. The ayin, the last letter of the first word, Shema, and the dalet, the last letter of the last word, Echad. Ayin and dalet are raised high, for these are there to be put together as one word, aid, the Hebrew word for witness. Our fathers were conscious of the fact that by reciting the Shema, they witnessed to their faith, and by reciting the Shema and living the life that the faith in the biblical God required of them, they were witnessing to God's truth and to his teachings and to the graciousness of his law and of his practice when it was developed and ramified within the communities of men. Now, they didn't know exactly how their example would lead others to the faith or to the way, but they were convinced that it would. Somehow, by the very act of Israel's being, loyal, they were making a significant, perhaps the most significant, contribution that anyone could make to the unfolding of the human drama, to the development of civilization. And this was enough for them. Their life not only had beauty for in itself, the simcha shel mitzvah, the beauty of the commandments, but it had a larger significance, a worldwide, a mankind, a significance to all the children of men. And then as we moved from the simpler years to the more complex years, suddenly our survival and the desire to remain as Jews became a question, problematic. In the 18th century, secularity began to intrude into our world. Men began to question all of the traditional religious assumptions and to assume that instead of all purpose and wisdom flowing down from God, what man could understand flowed from his own mind and from the research and that he could undertake. Truth was man-made rather than God created. And as secularity came into our world and as men began to question the religious enterprise itself, they began to develop out there in the larger world what one might call neutral spaces. No longer did a Jew who wanted to cease to be a Jew have to go to the baptismal font. He could simply assimilate, disappear. There were larger and larger spaces in the Western world where the Jew was now allowed to be a citizen of the nation, in which he could simply be another labelless human being. And the very option that this opened was an option which increased the problematic, the fact that each of us has had to face at one time or another the question, why be a Jew? Why stay on with this beleaguered people? And there were all kinds of new pressures on the Jews. Heine, in the early part of the 19th century, described conversion as a passport to Europe. And whether one converted or one assimilated, it was very clear that to remain a Jew was to willingly keep for yourself a number of restrictions. Limitations as to admission to the university. No lawyer who was a Jew could practice in many countries of Europe. Boardrooms were closed to Jews. Many parts of the community were places where he could not have a home. He could not enter the houses of parliament bearing his ancestral faith. There were all kinds of temptations now to reject the ancestral tradition. And he began to wonder if, in fact, the old teachings were sustaining. If in fact the existence of the Jew, qua Jew, did make a major impact in the world, was it all worth it? Why did Jews need to survive, except perhaps for a studied and sturdy determination that might and power and numbers should not have it all its way, should not simply be able to force us to give in to them? And so about this time, it was necessary for Jews to begin to think through the question of Jewish survival. And the first complex of ideas which they developed, they tended to call the doctrine or the assumption of the mission of Israel. This was a set of ideas which, in one way or another, drew on some old theological concepts about election and about the covenant, but put them into a new sociological and rather modern context. It said, in effect, way back in our history, at the beginning of our history, the genius of our people touched the very essence of religion. They were the first to pull religion out of paganism, out of polytheism, to ethical monotheism, to understand that there is one God and one creator, and that God is to be worshipped essentially not through ritual and not through ceremony, but through service, through community involvement, through the service of justice and of righteousness. The oneness of God and the concept of service which flows from it are universal values. And Judaism has the obligation then to teach these great universal truths to mankind, not only to witness to them by attendance at a congregation, by standing up and reciting the Shema, but by carrying them out in practice. This was an active doctrine. The Jew of Frankfurt, the Jew of London, the Jew of Cleveland was to take out the prophetic urgencies about righteousness and justice and the making of peace and weaving these into, forcing these upon the community of which he was a part. He was to be one of the shock troops of God in the cause of social justice. The 19th century was activist, and it was industrious, and it was a time when progress and themes about social change were very much in the air, and this concept of the mission of Israel fitted in nicely with those themes. It was not simply by coming and by praying and by affirming within the context of his community that the Jew made a contribution to the world. He was, to use an analogy which was a favorite of those who believed in this mission concept, he was to be the leaven in the dough, or the enzyme in the organism. He was to be the catalyst which brought about, precipitated, social change in the community of which he was a part. It's a noble doctrine. And if you read through the sermons which were preached from the pulpits of liberal Judaism over the last nearly two centuries now, you will find it adumbrated, suggested, exposed in one way or another. But there are a number of problems with it. In the first instance, what did one mean by justice, and what does one mean by righteousness? These are glorious words, but out of context, unless they're tied down to a particular in a social environment, social construct, they mean little or nothing or everything. Justice meant one thing to the self-satisfied German Jewish burgher of the 19th century, and quite another thing to a son who may have been a social democratic radical. Terms require context. They have to be tied to life. And these terms, though they were noble, meant everything or they meant nothing. Often they were said meaninglessly as conventional commonplaces. And this larger concern, this concern of definition, suggests another failing of this concept of mission. For it was completely outward bound. It said essentially to the Jew, you serve God significantly only when you are on the forefronts of social progress, only when you're out doing something politically or in the economic arena or making it possible for there to be peace in the world or labor legislation or welfare reform or a war on poverty. That's the way in which you serve God. And suddenly all that gives beauty and warmth and meaning to Jewish life, the observance within the home, the whole context of worship, the whole context of learning has been traditionally developed, ceased to have central significance, ceased to seem essential. And the Jew felt that he fulfilled himself in service, and the more he lived that kind of life out there, the less he lived the kind of life which keeps the Jewish soul Jewish, which warms the soul. And more his faith was denaturalized and denatured, devoid of specific construct. He was a good man, but his Judaism, though he was serving Judaism, he felt, became more and more questionable. There was another problem with this concept of mission as an explanation or a philosophy of Jewish survival. It had a hidden agenda. The Jew of the 19th century and the 20th century wanted above all else to be emancipated, to be a citizen, to belong. He'd been kept aside so long and kept out for centuries. And now finally in Western Europe and the United States, he was to be allowed in. And he wanted to put behind him anything within his faith which suggested that he was not a wholehearted 101% Frenchman or German or Italian or American. He wanted nothing of the concepts of corporate Jewish nature, of Jewish community, of peoplehood. God forbid, of nationhood. And so he began to interpret the concept of mission as one which invalidated all those old dreams among the Jews of a return to Zion, and as one which gave the lie to all the modern programs which spoke of an actual physical return to the Holy Land, all the programs of Zionism. For if Jews were to be a leaven in the dough, the catalyst in the countries of which they were a part, they obviously had to be there. And now the mission people reworked did away with essentially all the old visions of our people next year in Jerusalem that the Messianic age is somehow tied to the reestablishment of a Jewish state. And they looked upon the diaspora, which had once been called the exile, as a positive good. It was not a punishment. For it was only by being scattered and dispersed that we could, in fact, affect, be consequential in our world. A man who was the rabbi of Temple Emmanuel in New York about 40 years ago, a rabbi by the name of Enelo, put it this way. Do not ask my people to become Zionists and to go and confine their best energies within that little beloved land beyond the Mediterranean blues. God bless Zion, Israel's cradle and the prophet's home and the patriarch's great tombs. God bless those that seek the peace of Jerusalem, that even today would enhance its glorious beauty. Who will not rejoice to send loving gifts and ornaments to the silver-haired mother of ours, the mother of religion and divine progress. Will ye say that my people has toiled and loved these many years, that has struggled its way through the world, that has lived the strenuous and heroic life, that has taken part in the trade, the arts, the letters, the science, the politics of all nations, that has gone through all the flames and passed through all the waters and bled on all the battlefields in order now to go back to Palestine and to form a secluded spiritual sect or a tenth-rate political state? Ah, no. The very mission of Israel, then, required not only the continuance of the dispersion, but led many to oppose the establishment of a Jewish state. Now, I read to you this morning from the 42nd chapter of the book of Isaiah. Isaiah did not write this chapter. It was written by an anonymous prophet who lived during the Babylonian exile. And those who offered the mission as a rationale for Jewish survival delighted to in quoting from it. What does it do? It speaks of Israel as a light to the nations. It calls upon Israel to act in righteousness, to open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon and them that are in darkness out of the prison house, to do acts of social concern, social welfare, to lift man up to a higher state. Jewish life was tied to a larger meaning, as it must be. But Jewish life was also bled by the mission idea of its basic, intrinsic beauty, of those things which are special to us, of those things which give us, in a sense, soul. The problem is really with the mission idea was that it was just an idea. All apologetics are, any philosophy is. And ideas are infinitely ingenious, but they have meaning only when we relate to them, when we can take them into our lives and say, I agree. Another generation could agree to the mission, to the concept of mission. They felt it in themselves. They felt an urge to belong. They felt an urge to serve their communities. They believed in commitment. They believed in universal values. They believed in social progress. They believed that the dawn of the age of redemption was just at hand. But in our age, it's a little more difficult to do so. Because though they could look around them and see Jews on the barricades of almost every activity of social concern, whether it be the bourgeois liberal revolutions in 19th century Europe or the more radical revolutions in Eastern Europe late in the century, we now go to study the history, and we study not only Western civilization, we study the history of the world. And we recognize through those studies that part of the world where Judaism and Christianity have always been inextricably intertwined is really no longer for us the sum and substance of all of history. It's hard to believe that Jews are somehow the leaven in the dough, the linchpin of civilization. When we think of the great Indian civilizations, or the great Chinese civilizations, the civilizations of the Orient and of Mesoamerica, in which Jews literally played no part. There can be, obviously, civilization. There can be social concern without Judaism. And many of the greatest leaders of social progress in our generation, from Mahatma Gandhi to Martin Luther King, have been men who were not nourished from Jewish homes or nourished on particularly Jewish values. It's one thing to claim, as I think all of us would claim, I certainly would, that Jews have been remarkably useful to the world. And it's quite another thing to claim that Jews and Judaism are somehow indispensable. That without us, the civilization would shatter, it would disappear, or at least that social progress could not take place. We're a show-me generation, And the attempt by the in the 19th and 20th century by the mission rhetoric people to show how Judaism was significant. We had given the world the Bible. We had given the world its vision of social justice. We had given the world, the Western world in the 12th century, the whole philosophy of the East, of Greece and of Syria. It was Jewish translators who had brought this into Europe. In the 15th and 16th century, we had given to Christianity really its Protestant tradition, for it was Jews who taught the early Protestant theologians to read the Bible, our Bible, and to find in it the values which the church, their church, had neglected. It was Jews who in the 19th century resurrected the social imperative of the prophets, their sense of burning urgency for justice, and taught the Christian world the doctrines of social progress and the social gospel. In Europe, in the Western world, Judaism and Christianity are inexorably intertwined. You've only to turn on the radio any Sunday morning before you come to temple and listen to one of those radio programs in which a preacher preaches the gospel of prophecy to realize how important Israel is within the messianic constructs of fundamental Christianity. But it's one thing to see that evidence and to find in our generation, as in all generations, Jews and Judaism of real significance in the world, despite the smallness of our numbers. And quite another to claim that we are somehow an indispensable people, that without us, the world could not progress. That's to claim to us as an imperial claim. And most of us, I think, have learned to misprize all forms of imperialism. What then can we offer to ourselves as a justification for Jewish survival, as a philosophy of Jewish survival? I call this lecture this morning Towards a Philosophy of Jewish Survival. And I put emphasis on the preposition, towards. There is no philosophy of Jewish survival. There is no argument anyone can give anyone else why he ought to survive as a Jew or a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim or a Democrat or a Republican. We may have ideas, but each of us has to work out his own identity. Identity is not given, identity is achieved. And whatever ideas we have will have significance to another only if he opens himself to them and finds them significant and weaves them into the context of his life. But there's no guarantee. We're dealing here with apologetics, with ideas which yet need to be rooted in someone else's feeling. What can we offer then to ourselves as a vision of our philosophy of Jewish survival? Well, in the first instance, I would suggest to you that we begin not with ideas, but with ourselves. I am because I am, and I have an inalienable right to be. The Jewish people is because we are. And the very fact of our existence cannot be denied to us. The question of whether that existence will have significance rests on us. The world cannot really force us to ask the question, why need we survive? And so the question really isn't, what consequence does the survival of Judaism have for the world? But what is the consequence of the survival of the Jewish people for me? What do I find in it, which allows me to grow, to develop, to become, to transcend my limitations? Now, some of us still find some lay some importance in one or another of the mythic ideas. There are those of us who are determined to be Jews because so many out there are determined to destroy the Jews. Emil Fackenheim, sometime after the Second World War, said that there is now a new 11th commandment, thou shalt not give to Hitler a posthumous victory. And there are many of us, I think, who are determined deep down in our guts to remain Jews and to encourage Jewish life and support it in all the ways that we can, so that the Hitlers of the world will not be able to crow that they have been able to destroy a civilizing agent, which they feared. Might cannot have its way. And there are others among us who are moved, I am sure, by the very existence of the State of Israel. Not simply because it's there and in a sense it's ours, but because it is ours and it is a statement of new life, of new possibility. Mankind can be brutalized and murdered, and yet something in the human spirit is indomitable, rises from the ashes. Out of the Holocaust, we build a state. And out of the tragedies of modern life, mankind can build a graceful society, if he wills it and will sacrifice for it, as those who live in Israel have. And that, too, for many, is an encouraging statement, and one which leads to the support of all those things which are Jewish. But ultimately, I suspect the answer is a much more private one. Identity is not given. Identity must be achieved. And we become what we become because of the places in which we find ourselves and the influences which come to bear upon us. I am what I am because of my family. I am what I am to a certain measure because of the schooling that was offered to me in this community, because of the social context in which I lived in this community, to a very large degree. I am what I am because of the great traditions of the Jewish people, the historic encounters between Jews and God, the insights which developed over the long centuries were offered to me. And by taking them into myself as best I could, I found that I was encouraged to be part of a long, live, historic, and courageous and noble pilgrimage, and that I was given understanding, perhaps more than most, because the civilization, the culture which surrounded me was so rich in divine and human wisdom. The greatness of Judaism for us, my friends, and the greatness of the survival of the Jewish people is that it allows us to measure ourselves against and to live within one of the grandest, deepest, and most insightful of civilizations that mankind has ever evolved. Now, I believe in the far mystery. I believe that there is some ultimate significance to the survival of the Jewish people. I believe that God, in fact, touched the Jews with significance way back there at Sinai and gave to our people, the very existence of our people, some larger significance in the world. But what that significance is, I don't know. We witness by our being. And like a stone dropped into a pool, the ripples move out and out further and further from the center and touch some distant shore, and sometimes we can hardly see the shore. I don't know what that influence is or how our continuance as Jews does, in fact, affect the world. But I know that it has ennobled me and you, and that because of our exposure to this people, and its sacrifices and its heroism, and because of our exposure to this tradition, its wisdom and its humanity and its attempt to reach out towards God, we have grown and become more sensitive and become more concerned with family, with our own responsibilities, with character, with standards, with service. And I cannot but believe we have been the better citizens of the larger world for it. Yes, there is reason for the Jewish people to survive. There are reasons for all people who have a great tradition to survive. And those who are indifferent to all that the rich context of Jewish life can offer are the losers for it, because their lives are organized by some much more common, even vulgar values. Do you want your children to be sensitized by the values of the mass media or our long life tradition? That's really the question. Can the holiness of the Jewish tradition reach in, as it has, I think, to each of us who is here, and spark the holiness within and help us to grow and therefore to become and therefore to be of increased significance. Amen.